Well, 10 years, three election campaigns, countless headlines and stories on this very program, and still, readers seemingly can't get enough of the trials and triumphs of US President Donald Trump. A new book on the first year of the president's second term is capturing attention from Washington, D.C. to Canberra and beyond. The pair behind the pages are two New York Times journalists, Jonathan Swan and Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Maggie Haberman. The book is titled Regime Change, Inside the Imperial Presidency of Donald Trump. It's currently topping the New York Times non-fiction bestseller list. Jonathan Swan joined me earlier. A very warm welcome to Radio National Breakfast.
Thanks so much for having me.
How has Donald Trump's second term changed the boundaries and the norms of the office of President of the United States?
Wow, I could talk for hours about this, but let me try to summarize it. He didn't come out of nowhere. So there's been a sort of an expansion of power in the presidency over multiple presidencies going back at least 30 years and an expansion of executive power. Donald Trump has taken it to a level that we haven't seen in my lifetime. In some respects, we've never seen it in the US president, some of the ways in which he's using power. One is foreign policy. It's true that in the past, particularly Vietnam War, Korean War, American presidents have gone to war without Congress, without getting approval from Congress, which is the branch of government under the Constitution that's supposed to declare war. But in more recent years, that has not happened. And, you know, when George W. Bush took America to Iraq, to war in Iraq and Afghanistan, it went through a congressional debate. Donald Trump took America to war in the Middle East without any discussions with Congress. He went into Caracas and did regime change in Venezuela without any discussions with Congress. If that was the extent of it, you would not put Donald Trump in some really aberrant category. It's all the other ways in which he's used power which are extraordinary. One example that I think most of your listeners would be aware of is he's turned the US Justice Department into an instrument of personal vengeance. Since Watergate, there has been a pretty bright line dividing the president from the Justice Department in terms of ability to direct investigations and prosecutions of individuals. There are obvious reasons why many people think that that's unwise and not a good path to go down, to have one individual be able to say, I want you to prosecute this particular individual, this person. Trump has just completely obliterated that line. And you now have a Justice Department that is actively, aggressively pursuing investigations and prosecutions of Donald Trump's enemies, in many cases on charges that even senior officials at the DOJ consider highly questionable. You can look at the way he's using power, the whole Elon Musk experiment, bringing in the world's richest man essentially as a co-president in the early months of the administration. A lot of the stuff that Elon Musk talked about doing didn't end up getting done, but he still did quite a lot. And one example that tends to get glossed over, but, you know, we write about in the book and we get into behind the scenes on it, is, you know, there used to be this agency that existed called USAID. It was the primary agency for foreign aid in the United States, helping some of the poorest people on earth. Elon Musk shut it down. It's an agency that was created by Congress, and it was shut down on a whim, essentially over a weekend. Almost, you know, vast majority of its functions have been dissolved. The remnants were absorbed into the State Department. And that's before you even get to his efforts to use government power to coerce higher education, media companies, law firms. You know, as I said, I could talk for hours about it, but he's using presidential power in ways that are very, very unfamiliar in the American system.
Tell me about the process for this book, Jonathan. You're describing events in rooms that you were not in. How did you go about getting this information and this background?
We have a long sourcing note at the start of the book, which talks about... We started reporting for this book back in 2023. Maggie and I have covered Donald Trump for a long time. This is my 11th consecutive year of covering Donald Trump. I covered his first term. I covered all three of his campaigns. Maggie's first byline on Donald Trump was in 1998, so she's been covering it for more than 25 years. So we have immodestly very wide and deep sourcing in all of the rings of his network, whether it be people who work for him in the White House, campaign officials, government officials, people associated with the family and business and what have you. We lay out in the book the basis on which we've done interviews. So many of the interviews were done on the basis of deep background, which is journalistic jargon for we can use the information but not say where it came from, not say who the source was. And when we use direct quotes, it's either because it's the person speaking it and it's been verified by people who were there, or we have tape recordings, or we have transcripts. When we can't be certain about the precise language, but you know participants in the conversation agree on the gist of it, we tend to paraphrase. And when there are disagreements within accounts, we erred on the side of leaving out that material. We left out a huge amount of reporting because we couldn't be certain it was accurate. And there were some cases where we, you know, used our own judgment based on our experience with sources on who was reliable and not. I will say, you know, we have highly detailed scenes in the White House Situation Room in the Oval Office with very detailed dialogue. And we're now a couple of weeks after publishing. I'm yet to see a single person in any of those meetings deny any of the dialogue. Not one person give a denial of something that they said in one of those rooms. So it may happen. Trump may order people to deny things, but I'm still waiting for it.
Let's talk about this, an excerpt from the book about Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump meeting in the Situation Room. This quote says, "Netanyahu delivered his presentation in a confident monotone. It sounded compelling and well-prepared, at least to Trump. Sounds good to me," the president told the prime minister. To Netanyahu, this signalled a likely green light for a joint US-Israeli operation. Were you surprised by some of the decision-making processes? And these are very consequential decisions.
Surprise wouldn't be the word because, you know, again, when you've covered someone for as long as I have, as long as Maggie has, and continuously with no break, you see how his world evolves, how his inner circle evolves. It's a very different government from the first term, almost unrecognizable. The team, I mean, this is a group of sort of 5, 6, 7 people who are running the United States. And there are very senior people in the government who have no earthly idea about what's being discussed, what's being planned. There's not really an interagency process that is recognizable to previous administrations. The Netanyahu episode was astonishing. You know, I'm not aware of a precedent for a foreign leader to come down to the White House Situation Room. You know, Trump leaves his normal place at the head of the table, sits opposite him, and Netanyahu gives an audio-visual presentation. He's got a screen behind him. He's got the head of Mossad beaming in on the screen, generals, and he pitched Trump on this regime change war. But, you know, a lot of people read that scene in our reporting and come to, I think, a wrong conclusion that I don't think, you know, if you read the full context of our reporting in the book, you don't come away with. But this conclusion that Netanyahu kind of puppeteered Trump into this war. It's true Netanyahu had campaigned very aggressively to draw America into the war and was very persuasive. It's also true that Trump himself is much more hawkish on Iran and has been for a long time than many of his own team. And what happened after that meeting is actually in some ways even more interesting. So Netanyahu leaves and overnight the CIA does an analysis of his presentation. And the presentation, you know, included like a video montage of potential future leaders of Iran, you know, Reza Pahlavi, the son of the last Shah, Ahmadinejad. It had a scenario where the Kurds came across and helped overthrow the government. Anyway, so the CIA comes back and gives their analysis. And the CIA director, John Ratcliffe, the next day tells Trump in the Situation Room that Netanyahu's regime change scenarios were, direct quote, farcical. And then Rubio uses even stronger language. He says they're bullshit. And so Trump absorbs all of this. It's not like he wasn't warned. He listened to all of this and he said, you know, maybe they are, maybe they're not, but he thought it was worth
going ahead with the operation anyway, that it was worth trying. And at a very deep gut level, I think Trump, based on all the reporting that we have, all the people we've spoken to, Trump really seemed to believe that this would be a fast war, that Iran was a paper tiger, that they would collapse quickly, that all the scenarios he'd been warned about, the closing of the Strait of Hormuz, America running out of long-range weapons, none of that would bear out because the war would be over so quickly. So it's more nuanced. Bibi Netanyahu played a significant role, but so did Trump's own hawkish instincts and his own hubris and overestimation of the capacity of the US and Israeli militaries.
You're listening to Radio National Breakfast. I'm speaking with the journalist and author Jonathan Swan. If you take the politics out of it and look at the man, what is Donald Trump's greatest vulnerability or flaw? How do you see him?
Hubris. Trump has made a mistake that is not unique to American presidents, but in his case, it's on steroids, which is overestimated his ability to control events that he can't control. Iran is sort of the perfect example of that. When we went and Maggie and I went and interviewed the president for the book, it was March the 16th. It was the 17th day of the war. And he talked about his Venezuela operation where when they seized Maduro in the middle of the night. They sent Delta Force into Caracas, snatched him, overthrew the, you know, well, actually the regime was essentially in place. They just put a new leader in, Delcy Rodriguez, who was much more pliant. Trump felt like he had his puppet in there running Venezuela. He called that a one-hour war. And you could see that he had come to a theory that he didn't need to necessarily send in American ground troops and do what you normally need to do to overthrow a regime, but rather that you could topple the leader and the next person in would be so terrified of what Trump might do that they would essentially do what Delcy Rodriguez has done and become a much more pliant figure. There was not one piece of intelligence that supported that theory. I mean, the US intelligence community, of course, these are not idiots. They understand that the regime in Iran is fundamentally different from Venezuela. It's a regime that has much more depth, much more breadth. It's a much bigger country. It has a theological component that runs really deep. So this was sort of the ultimate endpoint of Trump being surrounded by people who almost entirely flatter him, don't really tend to push back on him, believe in him at a very deep level and believe in his gut instincts. And he sort of got absorbed in this magical thinking. That's what happened in Iran. And it was, you know, a very poorly planned operation as a result.
This book also discusses who might follow Donald Trump in 2028. You describe quite a remarkable conversation between the president and Rupert Murdoch in front of J.D. Vance and Marco Rubio. Tell us about that and who do you think Donald Trump will ordain?
Yeah, so this was in October last year, you know, a few months after Murdoch's Wall Street Journal published the story about Trump sending a very lewd birthday card to Jeffrey Epstein, and Trump went ballistic about it and, you know, threatened to sue Murdoch and all the rest of it. Anyway, this was a kind of lowering of the temperature dinner. Murdoch comes to the White House and they're in the blue room, which for any of your listeners who've been to the White House, very ornate, beautiful old room in the White House residence. And they're sitting around the table and it's Trump, Rupert Murdoch, Vance, Rubio, and some other staff. And Trump, in the middle of the conversation, he says, you know, Rupert, JD's great, Marco's great. I really, you know, it's hard to, I can't really decide. What do you think of JD? And Rupert Murdoch says, well, JD has the potential to be great. Very awkward moment. Vance sort of says, oh, gee, thanks, Rupert. you know, knowing full well that Murdoch had tried to persuade Trump not to pick him as vice president. And then Trump says, and what do you think about Marco? And Rupert Murdoch immediately just says, you know, Marco's brilliant. So, you know, he's been doing this sort of auditioning of the two of them and pitting the two of them against each other, which is very typical for Trump. Based on all of our reporting, it still looks like J.D. Vance is the most likely successor. But Trump's not going to make it easy for him. I think that Trump has a very good chemistry with Marco Rubio. He has a lot of donors in his ear pushing him to pick Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio historically has been much more pro-Israel than J.D. Vance, more hawkish on foreign policy, more aligned with the establishment historically. So there's a lot of skepticism in sort of old-line Republican circles about J.D. Vance, but I still think, based on all of our reporting, that Vance is in pole position to be the successor.
When we talk about some of the expectations and norms around the office of US president, post-Trump, will it ever go back to what it was before?
Well, in order for it to go back, it would require someone coming in and voluntarily giving back power, essentially voluntarily handcuffing themselves in certain ways, which is not impossible. But
will the public demand it, Jonathan, do you think, or do they not care about how it's changed?
I'm not so sure. I mean, the public wants results to a large extent. Let's just take the debate that's going on inside the Democratic Party right now. You have hardcore leftists, Democratic socialists who are picking up Democratic nominations around the country, who are challenging the party establishment. The call, the siren song of the hard left is we need to fight. We can't be voluntarily disarming. We can't be bringing, you know, a knife to a gunfight. We need to do exactly what the right is doing. And so I think there's a very decent possibility that you have a sort of more authoritarian-minded leftist candidate winning, essentially saying, look, Trump has shown us that you can wield power much more aggressively than people thought, and that many of the constraints were actually norms, not laws. And I'm going to be your champion. I'm going to use power for you, you know, for your priorities. So, you know, you've seen flashes of that, you know, with Biden trying to unilaterally cancel student debt, you know, Obama famously talking about his pen and his phone, using more executive orders to get things done. But you could have that on a sort of Trumpian scale on the left. I think that's possible for sure. The alternative is also possible. You know, after Nixon, there was such a demand from the American public for better government, and you did see some efforts to claw back power from the presidency and put in some restraints, and Congress kind of got its act together. That's also possible. The way the trends are right now in both parties, I would say the energy is more towards forceful action, unilateral action, whatever it takes to get what you want. And it feels very zero sum and polarized. But, you know, things can change.
I must ask you, there's an acknowledgement in the book to Australian journalist, acclaimed award-winning Australian journalist Pamela Williams, for her role in this project, in this book. What role did she play?
The biggest role you could possibly imagine. Oh, man. My whole career is almost due to Pam. Almost nothing I've done in my career would be without Pam. She's, like, coached me through every moment. She helped us as an editor on the book. She pushed us on our reporting. She was an integral partner. The book would be a shadow of itself without Pam.
Just finally, Jonathan, what do you know about Donald Trump now that you didn't know before you embarked on this book?
It really crystallized for me when we sat down with him. We had basically, one of the puzzles of this term was why does he care so much less about domestic politics and polls and all the things he really was quite responsive to in the first term. And the obvious, you know, kind of glib, quick answers to that are, well, he's, you know, he doesn't have to run for re-election. He's run his last race, et cetera, et cetera. It's actually, I think, something a little different from that. I'm sure that's part of it. But when we sat down across from him, we asked him about his presidential power, and he sent off one of his aides to fetch this document for us, and he handed it to us. And he said it was written by a historian. Side note, it wasn't. It was written by a former golf caddy businessman for Gary Player, who's a golfer, but whatever. The point was, the document declared that Donald Trump was the most powerful man who's ever existed on the planet. And it went on to compare him to what he described to us as the top 10. And it was eminences like Adolf Hitler, Mao, Stalin, Alexander the Great, Genghis Khan, Attila the Hun, you know, you get the idea. And he was sitting back with the paper and kind of reading it and sort of relishing in it. And there was no, it wasn't about morality. There was no mention. It wasn't like a moral comparison. It was just about raw power. It was interesting because the document was, you know, written in quite a peculiar way. Obviously, the source was peculiar. But the thesis of it was actually basically the thesis of our book, which was that Donald Trump is the most powerful U.S. president in our lifetime, because not just because he's in charge of the world's most powerful economy, the world's most powerful military, but he's willing to use the powers of the U.S. presidency in ways that others haven't. Trump, I think, is wanting to be a great man of history, a sort of Napoleonic, a figure that people talk about for generations. And in his mind, I think one of the ways to accomplish that is to add territory to the American continent. That's why he talks about Greenland, I think. He sees these large areas of territory in the Western Hemisphere and thinks, well, that really should be ours. He's talked privately and now publicly about Venezuela as a 51st state, and people kind of dismiss that as trolling. It's really not. That's exactly how he views Venezuela. He views it as a giant oil field, and Delcy Rodriguez, the new leader, as a sort of viceroy or governor that he appoints and directs. That's how he views the world. And so I think what you're seeing in this term is a willingness to take much bigger risks globally, because he's quite detached from domestic public opinion, and B, an obsession with imprinting himself in a way that is not erasable, whether it be building monuments to himself in Washington, renaming institutions, you know, achieving things on the global stage that will be talked about for generations to come. I think that's what's in his head as he goes through this term.
Jonathan Swan, thank you so much for joining me this morning. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.